Welcome to Fifth Draw Wild, everybody. I'm your host, Matt, and surprise, you're getting another Supersode this year. Okay, so our guest for this this extravaganza of episodes around a common theme here is Melissa. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's awesome to have you on here for this. This was a great idea, and you chose a topic that I'm very excited about.
Yes.
What are we talking about this time?
We are talking about the Dresden Files novels by Jim Butcher, which is a series of 15 novels currently. He's going to write more, plus there's side short stories and things. You have read all of them. I have only read the first five.
This is going to be a fun conversation. For our listeners who may not be familiar with this, the Dresden Files books are urban fantasy is the best kind of genre plug for them. They're set in more or less modern day Chicago, but in a world where magic exists as kind of its own secret world. There are werewolves, there are vampires, there are fairies, there are angels, there are demons. There are other things that I can't say because they are literally spoilers for you. There are wizards. That's important.
But Harry is the only professional wizard in Chicago. He is listed in the phone book under wizard.
Yeah, it's Harry Dresden is a piece of work. He is kind of a classic noir detective who does badly. Like, he's not good at it. That's what he wants to be, and he's just not very good at it.
No.
So, for a little bit of kind of nuts and bolts background here, the first book in the series, we're going to be looking at the first five, which are Stormfront, Full Moon, Grave Peril, Summer Night, and Death Masks. The first one was Jim Butcher's first novel ever. He wrote it in like a creative writing class, and the teacher convinced him to work on it and publish it.
Wow.
And originally,
I didn't know all that backstory.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a great little story. Originally he called the first book Semi-Auto Magic.
Oh, that's very good. And I am proud of him. He lives in Independence, Missouri. And I am excited to have this author as a fellow statesman. Not since James Gunn wrote the two live-action Scooby-Doo movies has a fellow Missourian done so good at telling a fun supernatural tale.
this is some good stuff. It's set in Chicago, by and large. These are great. Last I heard, his plan is to make 20 of these books.
Whoo.
And then do an apocalyptic trilogy at the very end.
Whoa! Oh. Okay, yep, that sounds like him.
So, that should be really interesting, I think. Again, this is one of those things where I have to be really careful because I know all the things that Melissa doesn't. And, man, I hope I don't screw this up. So, let's just dive into this. Tell me first how you got introduced to these books.
I first heard about them when Sci-Fi Channel did that television series in 2007. And
oh,
I
we're
going to
talk about that.
I never actually watched the TV series because it was around for such a short time. But, like, the promo image of that actor and like all the magical lights around him is like burned in my brain because that was the first summer we got a DVR and I recorded a ton of episodes of like Stargate SG-1 and like old X-Files reruns and I saw the commercial over and over again. And I knew they were based on these books that were really popular or like very beloved by the people who had read them. And I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. I'll have to check that out sometime. I grew up on X-Files, and that's a big cipher for me in the things that I enjoy. It's like, oh, supernatural detective series sounds perfect, and I just never got around to reading them until earlier this year I went to a book club at my friend Audrey's house, and this was not the book we were supposed to read, but it was me and Audrey and two other people, and they had all read them or were in the process of reading them, and that's all they talked about all night, and I'm like, okay, now is the time. I'm getting into these things too. And Audrey has been lending them to me, and I got, I don't know, just a handful of chapters into the first book. And I'm like, well, this goes, there goes the next couple months of my life. This is my new thing. I am so happy this came to me when I didn't even know I needed it so much.
Listen, they're very good. Whatever else we say in here, these novels are very good and you should read them.
Yes.
So let's start at the tip and work our way to the top.
Mm-hmm.
Book one, Stormfront. Tell me what happens in this book.
This is the most, so far, the most classically noir-ish story that there is. It's more like, this is a detective story with magic instead of the later books, which are more of, these are a magic story where he has a crime to solve.
Yep, 100%. That does not change.
And in this book, this woman approaches him and says, my husband has gotten into magic as a side hobby. He needed something to fill his time after he lost his job, and he's gone missing. It must have something to do with the magic. Harry Dresden, professional wizard and kind of private investigator, can you help me? Also, the husband's name is Victor Sells, which really threw me for a loop.
Yeah.
Which is a joke that's not going to make sense to anybody who is not familiar with previous guest of this podcast, Alan Sells, and his RPG character, Victor. But that was all I could think about the whole time I was reading Stormfront.
You know what? In a world that goes very, very dark and bad, I could see it. It's not great, but it could be there.
So he's got this missing person he has to find. And also, there is a crime he's to solve with the police. Harry is often brought in as a consultant to the Chicago PD's Special Investigations Unit, which is like their X-Files. This is where they put every weird thing they don't know how to handle. And the head of Special Investigations is Karen Murphy, who is the best.
Yeah, no, that is correct. She is, for now and for the rest of the series, the best.
And the first time you meet Karen, it's, these books are in first person, and Harry talks about how the two of them look completely opposite. Like, he's super tall and gangly, and he's got dark eyes and, like, really sharp, hawkish features. And Karen is, like, 6 foot nothing, like, small, athletic, and she's got bright blue eyes and, like, curly blonde hair, and she looks cute. Like, she looks like she should be a cheerleader, is what the book says. But she's so tough. She's so ferocious, and her partnership with Harry is my favorite thing in the entire series.
I'm going to go ahead and tell you one line that comes up much later in the series. It is a description of Karen by another person. This is all that they say about her. Tiny, but fierce.
Yep, that's her.
She is great. Karen Murphy is the best. I think probably the only character of this entire series, well, save one that we'll get to later, who never loses their moral compass.
Oh, thank goodness. So she has this crime she needs Harry to help her solve, which is that, not to be gruesome, but they have found some bodies with the hearts literally exploded out of their chest. And she's like, I know enough that this is magic. And Harry has to come look at it. And the first book is about Harry solving these two mysteries and about how the two of those intertwine with each other. And there's hard-boiled crime things. Like, he has to go talk to all of these different people. He talks to... Oh, after that, you meet Johnny Marcone, Gentleman Johnny Marcone, who is a recurring villain. He's just a classic mobster, nothing supernatural to do about him, but he's really entertaining. A terrible guy, but a really fun adversary throughout the series so far.
Oh, yeah. Marcone is great. Marcone is great.
You meet him, and Harry has to go into, like, a vampire brothel and talk to this vampire woman for information, and he talks to, like, a former prostitute, and he has to get information from her. Like, this is the, like, crime classic detective stuff in this book. It goes through a lot of those things. Like, I have to go here and talk to this person and get information from them. But then also one of his stops is, I gotta talk to this fairy. I have to summon this fairy and tempt this fairy with pizza, and then this fairy will tell me the things I need to know.
Yeah, oh man. That's Toot Toot.
Yes!
And you have not seen the last of Toot. He is... what a little pizza-addicted fiend.
This series is so great at coming up with these very memorable minor characters that Jim Butcher can then go and just pick up at any time. Like, not to get ahead of ourselves, but I love what he does with the alphas in the next book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we're going to talk about them. There are things that are laid out in these first, like, couple books
mm-hmm.
that don't get any attention or notice for so many books after.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah.
It's amazing what he does. Like, there's part of it that's like, I don't know how much you actually had planned, but dang, like, there's stuff that happens in Full Moon that doesn't come up again until the 12th book in the series.
Oh, and I love the stuff in Full Moon, so that is very exciting to me. Oh my god. I almost want to skip right ahead to Full Moon, because Full Moon has such great stuff in it. But first, we have to set up Susan. Susan is another person Harry talks to for information. More like she comes to him for information. Susan is a reporter for a supernatural newspaper that's, like, just a couple steps above National Enquirer in terms of its reputation. But she believes in everything supernatural. She loves her job. She's so fierce in going out and trying to seek the truth and make sure people know what's going on. And she really likes Harry. And the two of them have this flirty relationship with each other that turns into something really great and then turns into something really painful.
Yeah. And that's another thing that doesn't come back until changes. There are some things that happen that are, oh, Susan. Okay. Let's move on to Full Moon, book two.
Full Moon.
This is the book where he catches his stride.
Yes.
So what happens here?
Full Moon is all about werewolves, but as Bob lays it out for you, there's, like, five different kinds of werewolves. And to step back for a second, Bob is Harry's essential living computer. Bob is a spirit of intellect that is disembodied and lives in a skull and just exists as, like, two flickering flame lights in this skull's empty eye sockets. And he lives in Harry's basement. And Harry goes to him when he needs advice on stuff. Like, I've got tons and tons of records around here. You know them all. Please help me find what I'm looking for. You know everything, Bob. And so I always like the scenes where he goes down into his basement workshop and he's like, okay, Bob, wake up. Let's get to work. Help me figure out what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Bob is great. Which book are you currently on? You're on Blood Rites, correct?
I have not started Blood Rites. I wanted to hold steadfast to the first five books that I have set up for myself in this episode, and I have only read the back of the book and the first line of Blood Rites.
Well, number seven, Deadbeat, that comes after Blood Rites, you learn a lot more about Bob.
Good. I have a lot more I want to learn about Bob. Everybody's fun. Like, I don't think there's any side character that I'm like, oh, more of this person. All of them have their charms in some way, and all of them play off Harry in different ways.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. Okay, so we've got a bunch of werewolves running around Chicago. That can't be good.
No, nope. The big bad of this book is a loop guru, which is the worst kind of werewolf. This is the one where actually, like, the full moon curse comes into play. A lot of the other forms of werewolfism are, like, shape-shifting that's based on that person's choice. They choose through various methods to become a werewolf in shape for various reasons. This person is cursed to be a loop guru, and they are giant, and they are powerful, and they are going to tear Chicago apart unless Harry can stop them.
Yeah, and along the way, we learn that there's also, like, FBI agents who have decided to become werewolves.
Yes!
And, like, a band of college kids who have become werewolves.
They're the best. It's just these nerdy college kids that we don't even really know how they did it or why they did it, but they can shapeshift into wolves, and they call themselves the Alphas. Or do they call themselves that, or is that what Harry calls them? I'm actually not sure.
I don't honestly remember, but are they just the nerdiest. Like, they become Harry's D&D buddies.
Yes, yes. And they, like, he helps them out and they, like, adopt him. Like, you're our new best friend. And he's reluctant about it at first. Like, it's awkward for him. But then he does really come to care about these people. And I just love that this series has a recurring character that's just Billy the Werewolf.
Oh, Billy. Oh, Billy's great. And Billy's one of the few characters that really just, you get to be happy for him sometimes.
Yay! Harry, Billy is the best friend to Harry. Billy is so invested in making sure that Harry is well taken care of. Like, he buys him food. He buys him a poster for his apartment that has, like, tapestries and stuff to, like, keep it warm because it is a basement, but, like, there's no art in it. So Billy buys him, like, a Star Wars poster for Christmas or something. Like, here, Harry, you have to have something.
Yeah, Billy... okay, there's a lot of people in Harry's lives that are too good for him in a lot of ways, and Billy is 100% one of those.
Oh, I'm happy. We are so blessed to have Billy.
Oh, yeah. So what happens at the end of all this? Because they're building up to a real big showdown with a heap of wolves.
Oh, my God. At the end of it, Harry, he takes one of these magical wolf pelt belts, and he becomes a wolf. He becomes a wolf briefly. And there has been less fallout from that than I have expected. I don't know if that's one of those things that comes back plot-wise, or if that's just, like, a thing he can humorously reference sometime, like, oh yeah, and once I was a wolf for, like, 10 minutes, I got better.
Yeah, no, listen. That's really just a pretty tame experience for Harry, all things told.
yeah.
So, yeah, this... Now, I said this is where he catches his stride, where Butcher really finds his stride.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true... But there's not a lot here. Like, there are some things that come back, and there are some things that continually get referenced, and a lot of times, like, Harry will draw on stuff that happens in these first two books just to, like, remind Murphy about the stakes of things. Yes. It's like, hey, remember when those FBI agents we trusted turned into bad guys? Or remember Victor Sells? And... for a while, that just gives her PTSD. So, yeah, like, there's not a lot that really carries on, except that you're just like, okay, he can do all this stuff. It's the next book where things get interesting.
But to stay on Full Moon for a second longer, to give you an idea of how intense the personal stakes are in these books... Like, it takes a little while to get to the entire world is in peril. Like, larger stakes. Oh, yeah. But within Harry runs himself absolutely ragged trying to solve this mystery, trying to stop these wolves. And it gets to the point where he's so exhausted and so wounded that his body shuts down and his mind checks out and he's in this dreamscape and his subconscious comes walking out to him like, "Hi, Harry. I'm Harry. we have to sit down and talk through this or you're going to break.
Oh, and Subconscious Harry is so good.
The fact that that happens halfway through book two, I think really gave me an idea of, okay, I know what to expect from this series now. Also, like, his subconscious shows him, like, here's all these different people you're dealing with in your life right now. What do you really think about them, Harry? Like, stop and process it. What are you going to do? And, like, Murphy comes out and he has inadvertently done something to hurt her. And he collapses to his knees. Like, he feels so guilty about it. And his subconscious helps work him through it. Like, Harry, you can't protect her forever. You need to act like her coach. You need to explain all the magic stuff to her so she'll be able to really take care of herself and not call you when things get too tough. Also, you should ask her out sometime.
Yeah, he doesn't act on that for a long time.
Oh, okay. That I could figure. I can tell this is a long, slow burn. And I'm okay with that.
You know, Subconscious Harry, though, he comes back a lot.
Oh, and good.
It's weird when the id is more of a moral compass than the actual conscious mind sometimes. Harry's a trip of a dude. But let me tell you something really fun about Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Right around book 12, Harry is at a level where all of the events of Full Moon, he could handle without breaking a sweat.
I'm sure he could. Yeah.
Like, and that's not necessarily just like, oh, look how powerful and protagonist he's become. No, no. It's because his life has been hell for 10 years.
Yeah.
And he's just had to get tougher because of it. Like, the problems never get smaller.
No, they don't.
Case in point, our very next book, the problem gets a bit bigger.
Oh, Grave Peril is the most tense out of these 5 books so far. I'm just like on pins and needles, white knuckles, all the different metaphors, all of them through this entire book.
Let me tell you a true story here.
Yes.
We meet an organization in Grave Peril that becomes one of my favorite things in all of these books.
Oh, is it the Knights of the Cross?
The Knights of the Cross.
Oh, they're so great.
Oh, yeah, it's... Okay, so tell me about Grave Peril. Run down for me what's going on here.
Okay, in Grave Peril, there is an uprising of ghost activity, and Harry and his buddy Michael, who is one of the aforementioned Knights of the Cross, are trying to figure it out. And Harry eventually learns that this is an after effect of a some sorcerer that he dealt with months ago as just like fairly a case of the week sort of thing for him. But yeah, that guy, he is coming back from the dead with a vengeance. And also, the local vampires are up to some machinations.
Let's talk about the vampires real fast. So there's not just one type of vampire in this world.
Mm-hmm. There are multiple courts of vampires. Some of them are more like the traditional blood-sucking. Some of them feed off more like life energy, which are the sexy vampires. That's Thomas. Thomas is very fun.
There are 3 courts.
Mm-hmm.
There are the Red Court, which are... they're more along the lines of like a Vampire the Masquerade kind of vampire.
Okay.
So they're the really manipulative, highly organized, kind of on a royal structure, spread all over the world.
Yeah.
They're that group.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Black Court of Vampires.
Yes.
That were the Draculas. And they got eliminated after the White Council of Wizards had Bram Stoker write a novel that told about how to murder them.
That's right!
And then there's the White Court of Vampires that are like Twilight vampires, but not rapist pussies.
Yeah, they...
Fuck a Twilight. again, the important stance from Fifth Draw Wild to all you listeners out there. If you love a thing, you love it, man. More power to you. Fuck a Twilight.
Yeah, there's a romantic element to these vampires. They are glamorous, they are alluring, but they are dangerous, and the book never lets you forget that they are monstrous.
Exactly. And you're eventually going to learn more about that. That makes it even more painful down the road. Tell me what keeps happening here, because there's some big stuff that goes down in this book.
In this book, in the last book, in Full Moon, Harry's relationship with Susan kept progressing. He is now steadily dating her to the point where pious Michael is insisting to Harry, like, well, if you've been dating her so long, why don't you tell her you love her? Why don't you get married, Harry? It's the right thing to do. Michael's so great.
He is so pure and good. We don't deserve him.
Mm-hmm. So, Susan gets embroiled into this entire thing because she steals Harry's invitation to make a copy of it, and she sneaks into this vampire ball where the local bigwig vampire in Chicago is being named the new, like, head of a huge vampire congregation. Everybody is going to Bianca's ball. And she sneaks in there, and Harry's like, oh no, like, because you did this, you are not granted the laws of protection that are granted to me as an invited representative of the White Council of Wizards at this local magical gathering. You're in danger. And, oh, it's so painful because you know exactly why Susan did it. She's just like, there's a story there. I'm going to go find it out. And this would be an incredible move. It is an incredible move, but like, this would be so successful if she was dealing with plain mortals. But because it's vampires, she gets into real trouble. And Harry and Michael get into real trouble with her.
Yeah, it's, there's some stuff that happens here. Like, we meet a fairy. Like a proper one.
Yes, yes. There's so much crammed into this book that I'm like, oh yeah. Also, there is Leah, Harry's literal fairy godmother.
The Lenanshi. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. So remember how I said there was stuff that shows up here that doesn't really take effect for things down the road?
Oh, yeah. I am 100% aware.
So, Grave Peril is actually the starting point of a lot of stuff.
I'll bet, yes.
And again, stuff I cannot actually tell you about, but... Mm-hmm. Like, the Lenanshi is... I'm sorry, I'm saying that word like everyone out there would know it. So it's spelled... like, Leanonside.
Yes.
Leanonside.
Mm-hmm.
That last one, Side, is pronounced she.
Okay.
If you listen to the most recent Forging Worlds world that Alan and I built, every time we said she... that's the word we're saying.
Okay.
So, the Lenanshi is just a very, very powerful fairy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they actually say exactly how powerful, except that she's Harry's fairy godmother.
Yep.
I think you'll actually find out here in the next book how powerful she is. But we meet Thomas, who is amazing and important, and we learn stuff about the swords.
Yes.
The swords have a piece of a nail of the true cross worked into the blade.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't one of those, like, bullshit crusader relic stories. No, 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 no. This is a literally divinely empowered by God holy relic.
Yes.
It's so good.
They're playing with big stuff in this book. Again, like, every book boggles me that I'm like, this happens in book 2 of 15? This happens in book 3 of 15? And this seems like it might get to, like, a jump the shark territory, and it never does. It has not for me. Like, there's nothing that's like, okay, that's ridiculous. Because the whole thing has got, like, I mean, we're just talking about Harry's fairy godmother. That's silly. And it's so dramatic at the same time. And that's the space where this book lives in. This whole series is that Venn diagram intersection between the highest possible stakes and just being preposterous in, like, a really fun way.
So, this book ends with Harry burning down another building.
Yes.
But also, with Harry maybe just, oops, did I accidentally a war?
Yes, he accidentally a war. But he accidentally a war for Susan.
And how does she take that? Like, what goes on with Susan here at the end of the book? Because some stuff happens.
Susan has been bitten by a vampire. And the way vampirism, with this court of vampirism, the way it works, the other vampires may work differently. When you are bitten by a vampire, that's only part of the turning process. Then you are, like, driven mad with hunger. Well, it's not driven mad, but, like, you have this very, very difficult, desperate need to feed on blood. And you will feed on a person, and you will feed them dry. You will kill that person, and then your transformation is complete. And Susan, Harry informs her, like, she knows this is coming for her. And she's like, I can't do that, Harry. And I can't be with you because I would lose control. And he's in love with her. He wants to hang on to her. He proposes to her, and she has to turn him down and leave town. She's like, I can't be around you, Harry. I have to go, and I have to find out how I can possibly fix this. And then book four is Harry in a desperate mess. He has not been working. He has not been taking care of himself. All he does is hide down in his basement workshop and try and find a cure for vampirism.
Yep. It's intense. So, Harry's in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
And who comes knocking at his door in the next book?
This is Summer Night. This is book four. Who comes knocking at his door is Mab, Queen of some fairies. She is
the Queen of Arryn Darkness.
Queen of the Queen Winter
of Arctis Tor.
Yes.
The Queen of the Unseelie Fae.
Mm-hmm.
The Dark Elves.
Yes.
All the things that go bump in the night.
She puts on a crisp business suit and she knocks at Harry's office door and she says, your fairy godmother sold your bond to her, to me, in a deal. This is the deal I offer you. You will do three tasks for me. I will offer tasks for you. You are always welcome to refuse them. But you must do three in your lifetime. And then once you do the three, then you are free from my hold over you.
Oh, man. And what's the first deal that she... What's the first task she offers him?
There's two courts of fairies. There's the summer court and the winter court. Mab is queen of the winter court. The summer knight has been murdered. And Mab wants Harry to go investigate this. Because these two courts are at war with each other, a constant, eternal, spinning cycle. She's like, I know everybody is going to suspect it was me. Go out there, find who really killed the summer knight.
Now, let's talk about the knights real fast, because the knights are weird.
Uh-huh.
We learn a little bit about the fairy in this book, quite a bit, actually. So what we learn is that the power structure is this. There are the queens, Mab and Titania. There are the ladies, Maeve and Aurora.
Mm-hmm.
And there are the mothers. That's it.
Yeah.
They don't get names. And whenever, eventually you do meet them, and they are terrifying. Like, little lowercase g god powers.
Uh-huh.
When they show up. So the Summer Knight is part of that structure in that the Summer Knight is a human who is bound to serve the Queens of Faerie.
Mm-hmm.
All of them.
Yes.
Summer serves Aurora, Titania, and the Mother on that side. The Winter Knight serves Maeve, Mab, and the Mother on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And they're humans. They're mortals. They're designed to basically, like, be the assassin of the court to go and enact the will of the queen. And this one died.
Yeah, which is supposed to be real difficult to do. So Harry has to figure out what magical means could have killed this man and who did it and why.
Yep.
And he also kind of has to prevent a giant war from brewing between these two fairy courts. And of course, there's some sort of a symbolic battle, like the, you know, the turning of the moon to the sun with the seasons, a very mythological battle between them. But this time it could turn literal and it could turn bad. Like, global weather pattern destruction is the beginning step. Like, if Harry does not fix this, the world's gonna be in an ice age 20 years from now. So this is the first time the books really get into, okay, everyone is in danger, not just maybe a couple dozen people around Chicago.
Yeah, and here's the other thing. The White Council of Wizards, Harry immediately turns to them and goes, "Hey, so help?" And they go, "Nah."
Yeah.
And worse than that, they say, "No, it's your problem. Go fix it."
But the wizards, there's kind of a deal going on. The wizards are now, the White Council is at war with the Red Court of Vampires after Harry crashed that party, destroyed that party at the end of Grave Peril. So,
oops, a war. Yeah.
And another thing we haven't mentioned yet is that wizards' powers completely interfere with technology. Harry's apartment has no electric lights in it. He doesn't have a fridge. He has an ice box. His car is an absolute heap that miraculously keeps driving around.
Oh, it's a beetle, and he calls it the Blue Beetle because he's a nerd, and I love it.
And it's had so many pieces replaced that it is no longer predominantly blue anymore.
Yeah, that poor car. Oh, that poor car. They can't... It gets to the point where eventually Harry just starts to channel that, like, destructive energy field to just ruin technology when he wants to. It's pretty great. He just, like, starts blowing up computers when he gets mad sometimes.
But yeah, so this interference with technology means wizards can't fly in a plane. The plane would go down. But the vampires can do this. The vampires can travel all over the place. So the wizards need to guarantee themselves safe passage through what is known as the Never Never. And this is the sort of mystical underworld where all of these magical creatures live and humans can travel through. And it has these, like, it compresses space, it compresses time. They can travel through the Never Never, and they can get to Russia, where they need to go to investigate these vampire happenings. And they won't, you know, have to crash a plane to do it. So, they...
Yeah. Down the road, like, eventually Harry's able to step from Chicago to Edinburgh in, like, an hour.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's exciting, because it's been 5 books in Chicago, and Chicago is so big and such a, you know, fun setting for a book.
Oh, you don't explore Edinburgh. That's just where the White Council's at.
Oh, that's just where they are. Okay.
They live in caves underneath Edinburgh.
Of course they do. Yeah, I...
Because Merlin.
Yeah, because Merlin. Yeah, you don't really get outside of Chicago in these first 5 books, but you don't miss it. It's not something you really notice, that the geographical map ways limits of these books are fairly small.
Eventually they do widen out rather significantly. So, who killed the Summer Knight?
Oh, it is the Summer Lady.
What?
Yeah, and it's this whole complicated puzzle. Could I even explain it to you step by step? I'm not 100% sure, because mostly what I took out of this book is the long chunk in the middle where Harry and Murphy fight the Chlorofiend.
Yes! In a closed Walmart.
This is the point where he's like, okay, Murphy, I'm spilling it. I am telling you every magical thing I have kept from you before because I thought it would protect you. I'm done with that. Like, you deserve to know this stuff, and I really need your help. And he's like, we need to talk someplace that's quiet enough that people won't hear us, but also public enough that, like, no, it's less likely that somebody will come sneaking up to attack us. And she's like, I got it. And they meet in this little, like, sandwich counter of a restaurant inside a giant Walmart supercenter, and then they fight a plant monster in the Walmart garden center, and it's incredible.
Yeah, it's that's an amazing fight. That's a standout moment in all these books. Here's something very, very true. You said you didn't know if you could explain all the steps that led to Aurora killing the Summer Night.
Yeah.
You can't, because you don't know them all.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of felt like, am I just not great at mysteries? I'm not great at figuring out mysteries, Matt. Like, I think you can know this from the last episode of Lost Library I played. I'm not great at solving a mystery. And even when I have a mystery centaurs explained to me... You didn't say there were footprints, Matt!
I was trying to do another thing, okay?
Even when I have a mystery explained to me, I'm like, I 80% get what happened. But yeah, it's nice to hear that, okay, there's additional machinations and motivations that have not been revealed to me yet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. How did Harry fix this? How did Harry make it all better?
Harry gets from the two mothers, the Winter and Summer Mother, he gets an unraveling, which is like a little knit square, like a little like it's a little fabric square. It's part of a quilt or something. And the mothers say, this can unwork any magic. And Harry is tempted to keep it for himself because this can fix Susan's vampirism problem. This can turn her back to a full human. But no, he has to use it to fix this problem and stop a girl who has been turned into a statue so that she can't be killed on the magical table and have her blood spill over to the Summer side. Or was it the Winter side? I don't know, but it is Aurora's plan to throw the fairy balance of power completely off balance. She's like, I don't want this, like, little fight we have to keep continuing infinitely. It's time for one of us to win.
Yeah. She goes a little nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in ways that you don't get all the pieces for yet. Harry deals with her in a, I think, an objectively gross, but also objectively creative way. Because fairies have very few things can hurt a fairy, especially from a mortal. But we have one tool that we can use against them.
Iron.
Cold iron.
Yes.
And what does Harry do to this poor lady?
He unleashes a bunch of tiny fairies armed with just box cutters.
Yep. Tootin' his army. Go charging in. And death by a thousand cuts, Aurora.
Yes. See, that's what these books are like. It's, oh, that's such a dramatic twist. I never saw it coming. That's ridiculous, but it works 100%.
Harry rolls up it for a massive, like, cosmic fight with just, like, a purse. And everyone's just looking at him weird, and he's like, don't worry about it. And then it comes down to it, and he just opens it, and this death swarm of pixies with box cutters come out, and Aurora gets turned into goo.
And then it has been a job well done, and he's kind of learned to, like, put himself back together and stop obsessing over how to fix Susan's problem. And he's like, I'm going to cut my hair, I'm going to shave, I'm actually going to be a responsible working adult, and I am going to go try and be social and play Dungeons and Dragons with the alphas. But I don't want to have to think that hard, so can I play a barbarian, please?
Yep. It's great. Oh, I love it. So we end on that joyful note with Harry having saved the world again.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens next?
Okay. Death Masks involves the Shroud of Turin. The Shroud of Turin has been stolen, and a priest from the Vatican comes to Harry... because it has been stolen and taken to Chicago, he believes. It's not like he's like, there's one person in the world who can help us. It's like, this is the most qualified person in the city where this thing is going to be at. It's Harry Dresden. He kind of knows this stuff. Harry is hired to find the Shroud of Turin. And also there's mysterious murders again going on that Murphy needs a hand with. And Susan's back.
Susan's back, and more importantly, we get introduced to the other two Knights of the Cross.
Yes!
Shiro, who is fantastic.
Yes.
And Sonya, who is my best friend in the world.
They're both so good.
Oh, Sonya is so great. So, this is a thing that becomes very, very true very, very fast in this series.
Uh-huh.
And it becomes almost a trope to the point that it becomes, like, subverted.
Mm-hmm.
Almost immediately as well. If a Knight of the Cross shows up, things are bad.
Yeah. Yep.
If that, more than one Knight of the Cross shows up, things are apocalyptic.
Yes.
And all three are here.
Are there only three? Because I wasn't 100% clear on that, if it's like, this is all of them, or here's some of them.
No, that's all of them. There are only three swords.
Okay, all right. Well, I guess that makes sense, picturing how many nails were on a cross.
Yeah, it's following the traditional story of there only being three nails. We find more stuff out in later books, more about the history of the knights, but that's not relevant to this conversation yet.
Mm-hmm.
They're all here... because their mortal enemies are here.
Yes.
The Denarians.
Thank you for saying the magic fantasy word I couldn't remember off the top of my head. These are essentially super bad demons that are people throughout history that have been tempted by one of Judas's 30 pieces of silver, and they turn into these horrible monsters.
So what it is, it's not necessarily a demon.
Okay.
It's actually the origin, I think, of the demons. Yeah. These are proper fallen angels.
That's right. Yep. That's exactly it. That's the most correct.
And they were bound to the 30 pieces of silver, the denarius, mm-hmm. Which was the coin at the time. And now, basically, they get handed down to these wielders who are tempted by power, and you kind of get two types. You get the type that's, like, really in control and, like, a partner with the demon, or with the fallen angel, and you get the type who's a puppet for the fallen angel.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, like, their human forms, and their battle forms.
Oh, yes.
And some of these battle forms are bonkers.
Yeah, this series is really inventive with what all the different monsters look like.
Yeah. And we don't meet all the Denarians. I think they give a number, like, there's X amount out in the world right now that, like, the Vatican actually has, like, X of them locked up, X of the coins locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that the Knights of the Cross are around to fight the Denarians.
Yes.
the whole deal with heaven and hell in this world is balance. So where one force moves in the form of the Denarians, the other side is allowed to move in the form of the Knights.
Mm-hmm.
And that can expand and contract across all different scales of things. So, but of course, like, the demon side doesn't play fair. But the angel side has to play fair.
Oh, yes, they do.
And that can have some really nasty results, as we'll see. So, what's the deal with the Shroud of Turin? What's that doing?
The Shroud of Turin has been stolen by these three thieves that steal relics, and they call themselves the Church Mice. Because, again, so good. This is the tone of these books. And eventually you find out that the purchaser of the Shroud of Turin was Gentleman Johnny Marcone.
Bow, 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 bow.
Because he has what appears to be a sick daughter in a coma, in a long-term coma, and he believes that the healing powers of the Shroud of Turin will help bring her back. And when this book ends, we don't know if that worked or not.
Oh, Melissa. It's not his daughter, though. We learned this from Harry's soul gaze with him. It's some innocent bystander who was caught in the crossfire of an attempted hit.
Oh my god. I, like, guessed based on the ages, like, oh, this might be, like, a secret daughter he has. Oh my god. No. Oh my god. That's worse, Matt.
And he's just taking care of her because he feels guilty.
Oh, listen. I missed that. I didn't get that. Oh my god.
There's no such thing as a two-dimensional character in these books.
No, everyone is so rich. The people you meet for, like, brief snippets of time feel so lively.
And it extends out to these, like, villain types like Johnny Marcone.
Yeah.
And Nicodemus, the leader of the Denarians.
Yes.
When you learn his story, there was a time I almost cried because of something about him.
The last time we talked and I mentioned, like, oh yeah, today I was reading through some of the Dresden Files, and you're like, I love these books, they get really exciting. That was right before I got to meet Nicodemus, and I get to Nicodemus and I'm like, yeah, this feels very Matt to me. This looks thing Matt would like.
the conflict between the Knights of the Crown or the Knights of the Cross and the Denarians, and their associated, like, angel and demon counterparts and whatnot, that speaks to me on a big level, and, like, that inspires a lot of, like, the origin stuff for Grayscale, so...
Yep, I could see it.
Don't take my view of certain angels with you when you meet them in these books.
Absolutely.
So I characterize them differently.
Sure.
That the inspiration's the same. So what is Nicodemus's deal? Why is he even here? What's he even doing?
He wants to tempt Harry, and he tortures Harry, and he also teases Harry by calling him, like, oh, Harry, yes, Maggie's youngest. Harry barely knows his parents. His mother died in childbirth. He knows almost nothing about her. All he knows is that she left him his silver pentacle amulet that he never takes off, and that she was the one who bonded him to his fairy godmother. So he has very few facts about her, but he's like, my mom was into some sort of magic thing. And he never really got to learn more about her because his dad, like, died very suddenly of just a brain aneurysm when Harry was 6. And he has no any other family. So Nicodemus throws this thing out there, like, Harry, you have more family out there. As, like, trying to, like, get Harry to fall into this trap to find out things about his family. And Harry's like, I need answers, but I can't get them like this.
Oh, let me tell you a fun thing. Are you familiar with Gravity Falls?
Yes.
Okay, so if you've heard our supersode on Gravity Falls, Jake Scoot and I had a thing that we all kind of said, which is, the journal never lies. Nicodemus never lies.
Mm-hmm. And fairies never lie either, so...
Well, okay, with Nicodemus is much more like the journal, where he never lies. He also doesn't ever tell you everything you need to know.
Yep.
And eventually, when you figure out what the blacklight version thing for him is, you're like, oh, okay, so you don't lie, but you're also not trying to help me at all.
Nope.
Yeah, it's, oh, boy. Yeah, you're gonna meet more about Harry's family later on down the line.
Yeah, I want to throw a couple bananas. Theories your way when we're done recapping this book.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And then we can come back in like 6 to 8 weeks whenever I've read the next five, and we will see how many things I was wrong about.
It's fair. So, how does this book... Because there's another story happening here as well. There's another layer to this.
Yeah, well, I mentioned that Susan has come back. Susan mm-hmm. has come back. She tells Harry because she left pretty suddenly. She's like, I am here to formally quit my job reporting for the Supernatural newspaper, because while she'd been gone, she'd been like mailing articles into them. She's like, I'm here to formally quit, and I'm here to just get my stuff out of my apartment. And... her and Harry, like, they still love each other so much, and both of them know why they can't be together, and they have one last night together, which is an entire thing. If we even want to get into all of that, and the earlier scene that plays off of.
Let's just say, they enjoy some adult time together, and yes, that's all that really needs to be gone into. But it's not just her. There's a very powerful vampire that's around that's not really thrilled with Harry.
Yes, the leader of the Red Court of Vampires is there to duel Harry, to kind of help settle this big war that's been raging in the background between the White Council of Wizards and the Red Court of Vampires. And he challenges Harry to a duel. And I love the way they use setting, like, the way setting is used in these books, because they go fight in Wrigley Field when it is empty, like, really late on a February night. Like, that is the giant battleground they have, is Wrigley Field.
Oh, yeah, and we also meet the arbiter of the duel, the Archive.
The Archive! She's knowledge of everything embodied in this little 7-year-old girl, and Harry's
Every written text in human history is in her head. Everything written down, she knows.
And... she's a being of immense power and knowledge, but she is also a little girl. Like, Harry is a pet cat. We have not even talked about the pet cat. That's Mister. Mister is very important. Like, when she goes to visit Harry, she's acting all, like, solemn and otherworldly and ethereal. And then Mister comes in and she's like, Kitty! And Harry's like, I can't just call you the Archive. How about Ivy? Archive, Ivy, I'll call you Ivy. And she's like, I like Ivy. And it's really sweet.
Yeah. The Archive is a thing that comes back and is terrifying in its own right.
Of course.
Especially when you learn the history of the Archive and poor Ivy. So they have this duel and... the vampire cheats.
Yes, but Harry is saved because Susan's traveling companion, a fellow, like, half-pseudo-vampire like her that she met out on her travels, he was aware of the whole thing, and him and Susan are there kind of to make sure that this vampire doesn't cheat. And so they're hiding up in the bleachers with, like, sniper rifles. Or, well, he is. I don't think Susan actually knows any of his plan. And he's like, I wasn't going to let that happen. We weren't going to let Ortega win. It ends in this, like, draw.
Yeah, and so Ortega gets to leave. until we meet Ebenezer McCoy.
Oh, McCoy is the best. Again, another Missourian. My heart goes out to every Missourian.
This old man is, I think, the definition of good old boy.
He is. He is a farmer from down in the Ozarks. He goes to the White Council of Wizards, like, high meeting, wearing his wizard robe, but underneath that, it's just overalls. Like, he is dressed like my grandpa, and I love it.
And we learned that he was Harry's teacher.
Mm-hmm.
After some other stuff happened.
Yeah. We've not even broached that branch of things in this episode.
Yeah, we learned about that a little bit in Summer Night, about Harry's childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So Ebenezer was his teacher, and apparently also Ebenezer is an insanely powerful wizard who gets a little bit annoyed that Ortega tried to murder his favorite student.
Yeah.
And drops a satellite onto his house.
A satellite that him and Harry had seen in a telescope when they were learning astronomy when Harry was a teenager, and they thought it was like a shooting star, and they named it Comet Dresden. And then they're like, oh no, it's just a satellite. And then Harry's like, you took my enemy down using Comet Dresden.
Yeah, he orbital strikes Ortega's entire compound.
Yes.
We'll get into that later because, as it turns out, there are rules of magic. And the first one is, don't maybe murder people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And hey, guess what? McCoy can murder everyone.
Yeah, I believe it.
Oh, no. He is allowed by council law to murder anyone.
He's some sort of an enforcer. Earlier you were talking about how every villain gets multiple sides to them. I am so interested to learn more about Morgan, because Morgan is such a jerk, but I need to know why he's such a jerk. And I know he says Morgan. That somebody close to him died in this vampire attack on this, like, wizard tower, and I'm dying to find out more about that thing.
Oh, Morgan. I love Morgan so much.
I am so excited to hear that you love that guy, because he is the closest it gets to, like, being a stock character. He's just, like, this big bully enforcer for the Wizard Council that is there to watch Harry and make sure Harry stays in line. And he slips up for that, well, doesn't slip, but he reveals himself for that one line, like, Harry, you started this war with the vampires. The vampires attacked this wizard tower. Somebody I'm very close to was there, and they died. And that's all we have learned. And this guy, he hasn't shown up in a little while, and I'm so interested to see what he's up to when we get back to him.
Yeah, Morgan, I think, has one of the most intense stories. It's pretty great. So that's going to kind of wrap up the first 5 books in the series.
Mm-hmm.
Down the line, we're going to talk about books 6 through 10 and then 11 through 15 in 2 other episodes. Just to like part the kimono here, we're recording in May of 2018. you're shooting to have these all read by October. So we'll see. This might be like November, December when this comes out. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited for you to keep going on this because you're actually getting into what I think might be the most interesting 5 of the 5 books.
Ooh. Yeah, the back of Blood Rites has me so intrigued, and I have thoughts about it. If you would like to have a little section for Melissa's probably bad theories.
Yes, I want you to tell me what theories you have now. I'm not going to comment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to spoil anything for you here. Tell me what you think.
Okay, so the back of Blood Rites talks about how Harry, he's involved with Thomas and Thomas's White Court family. And it says, his investigation leads him straight to Thomas's oversexed vampire family. Harry's about to discover that Thomas's family tree has been hiding a shocking secret, a revelation that will change Harry's life forever. And I know based on what Nicodemus said in the last book, I am being led to believe, led to speculate that Thomas or somebody in his family is, like, one of Harry's older half-siblings that was maybe bitten and turned into a vampire. But that's too simple. We don't know how old Thomas really is. What if Thomas is, like, an ancestor of Harry's? Like, he is Harry's grandpa, and he looks like he is a decade younger than Harry.
Okay.
That's
okay.
That's a theory.
That is a theory for sure. Yeah. So what else you got?
I think that, oh, his mom is up to all kinds of magic nonsense, or she was when she was alive. I doubt she is still alive now, but who knows? Anything could be pulled on me. I theorize, and I like the idea that his dad has always been just a guy who was wrapped up in, or tangential, parallel to magical things beyond his understanding. Maybe he might have had shady things that were very mortal things, like plain old human crimes or something. There's no magic on Harry's dad's side of the family. His dad was just a plain, hapless stage magician.
Okay.
That's a theory.
That's a theory.
In the fifth book, we have 3 swords of the cross, 2 knights of the cross. The third sword is going to Murphy. There is precedent for this. This third sword, all the 3 swords are different styles. It's like a big, like, Arthurian broadsword. It's like a saber, and it's a katana. And Murphy is a martial arts practitioner. And there's a scene where, like, Harry goes to her house, and it's this very cute house. She inherited it from her grandmother. But then, like, on a rack over the TV are these, like, swords. And he's like, oh, there's the Murphy I know and love. So there's precedent for this. She knows how to handle one, I'm sure. She is an angel, pretty much, as we have seen in Harry's true sight. He turns his true sight on to investigate something. A wizard's true sight is, it peels away everything, all glamours, and it lets you see the very truth of things. And Harry rarely uses it because it's so draining, and you can see very brutal things. And it's stuff that never fades from your memory. With true sight, everything you see remains as fresh in your memory for the rest of your life as if you were just seeing it right in front of your eyes. So he, as like a last resort, he pulls on his true sight to investigate something, and then Murphy bursts into the room, and she appears with like this golden coronet of hair around her and these glowing azure eyes, and her true self is holding this big flaming sword, and she bursts in like this guardian angel, like righteous and furious and beautiful and terrifying to behold. So she is figuratively Harry's guardian angel, and I think this sword is going to go to her.
Okay, that's an interesting theory.
And I am going to say, because honestly, the relationship between the two of them is my favorite part of this book. Like, you kept mentioning all these plot things, and I'm like, yeah, I pretty much remember that, and I think that's what that was called, but, like, every beat of their relationship is what I have memorized. And I am going to say that she is farther along towards the romance end than he is. I think instead of Harry realizing, oh, I'm in love with Murphy, how can I ever tell her? He's going to be, like, struck, like, oh, I think she really loves me. I never realized this, because Harry, as we've seen, is always a day late and a dollar short. He always puts all the pieces together just when it's too late in all of his mysteries, and I think that is going to happen to him romantically as well.
Okay.
And Harry's cat, Mister, is giant, like a huge 30-pound cat, and it has been joked about, and I'm going to say that if Mister is not actually some sort of magical creature and not just a giant cat, if he's not actually a magical creature, there's going to be a point where somebody points at him and is like very seriously like, Harry, are you sure your cat isn't magic? Like, let's really test this. Let's really confirm this. This is an unnatural earth cat. So that's kind of a silly one. And then also, I do know the titles of the books to come. What number book is it? It's like 8 or 9. Book 9 is called White Knight. Knight, like, you know, when it's dark outside, not like the people with swords. White Knight has such a matrimonial sound to it. I think there will be a wedding involved. I don't know if it will be an actual, like, plot-centric wedding. I don't think Harry's going to get married. But I think it would be hysterical if, while he has to solve some giant supernatural problem, he also has to be a groomsman in Billy and George's wedding. So, I am throwing these concepts out at you, Matt.
You're throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall here.
I know most of this is going to be wrong.
I'm interested to see how much sticks down the line for you. So,
and finally, I don't think you get to 15 books without broaching the idea of biological parentage at some point. I don't know if Harry has a kid, but the story will brush up against that. I do know enough that later he has a young protege, a young apprentice, but beyond that, there will be a... He has unprotected sex with Susan? And I don't know if that's, like, intentional, if that's Jim Butcher teasing us that Susan is going to come back later with Harry's child, or if he's like, I just didn't think about it. I read a lot of romance novels on the side when I'm not reading these. It doesn't come up a lot of times for just non-plot related reasons. It's not like this is a hint to something later. It's just not in there. So I don't know how to read that. I don't know if I'm supposed to take it exactly on surface level or if, yeah, Susan comes back later like, Harry, this is your semi-pseudo fractional vampire kid I didn't know how to introduce you to.
So interesting.
That's them.
Very interesting.
Yep, and in 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to revisit this, and we're going to look at every way in which I was wrong.
Yep. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap us up for this episode. Melissa, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you online?
I am on Twitter at WilkyWit, WILKYWIT. I am a cast member in your Lost Library campaign Grayscale.
Hey. At the time of this recording, our second episode, your first episode, is coming out tomorrow.
Yes, I'm very excited. And also, just 2 days ago, we recorded a one-shot for Lost Library that went very well and may also turn into a continuing campaign. We'll see how that plays out.
We'll sure see. There are things moving behind the scenes. So, hey, I've got a bumper that fills you in on all of our information. So we'll be back for our next episode soon.
Bye.
You can find us on the internet at fifthdraw.com, follow us on Twitter at fifthdraw, or email us at social@fifthdraw.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Hoadley. If you enjoyed this episode, why not give us a rating and a review, or maybe tell a friend? Getting the word out helps us immensely. Our music is Arcade Montage by Lee Rosevere and can be found at the Free Music Archive. That's all for this week. We hope you'll join us next week for another episode. And hey, thanks for listening.